Michael Green, Chief Strategist and Portfolio Manager for Simplify Asset Management. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
So, Michael, you've recently taken a very, let's say, non-consensus view on bonds. I think this is an interesting idea to kind of wrap our minds around. As we were kind of discussing before we hit record here this morning, the idea of being able to objectively look at data and try to help educate one another is something that has been, I think, really muddied over the past couple of years, because you can find any piece of data on the internet now to reinforce what you believe instead of trying to be very objective about looking at any of these things. So I'd like to start with your view on bonds as an appropriate place to park capital or to seek a yield at this time, and why that is.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are really critical. First, I completely agree with you that we have moved into a world in which any worldview can effectively go out on the internet and find enough supporting data to convince itself that it's correct, whether that's because you think that bonds are interesting or you think that bonds are poison. You can find that. And so I don't hope to convince anyone in this process. I've already acknowledged that I probably won't convince anyone in this process. More of my emphasis is on identifying how much the yield has changed, how much the structure of the bond market has changed, how the structure of passive bond bids is actually leading to neglect, particularly for longer dated coupons, and walking people through mathematically why that works. And also trying to help people understand what inflation means in an economic sense. I think it's really critical to understand that inflation does not mean prices change. That's actually what capitalism means. Capitalism means that prices change. We use that as information to allocate both our own budget and also for capitalists or producers to decide how much to produce, where to ship it to, et cetera. So it's a little inflammatory, and I understand how difficult it is for people to hear this, but it's a blessing that prices change. The worst possible outcome is government fiat says the price of X remains the same at all times. That is actually incredibly unhelpful from an allocative mechanism standpoint. What we need to understand inflation as is a rise in the general price level that indicates that there has been a loss of purchasing power in aggregate. Not that your ability to buy eggs has decreased or your ability to buy milk has decreased, but your ability to buy basically everything has decreased. That's why we track inflation. We want to understand the distortion that is created by a rise in the general price level that leads us to misunderstand an increase in price for milk, not as a signal for additional milk, but basically as a signal for either less credit or for less money. That's part of the real challenge right now. I think people are unfortunately very upset, and understandably so, from the price disruptions that occurred in 2021 and 2022 as we reopened the economy. There were many distortions and disruptions in the supply chain that had to work their way through. And because we have a significantly less competitive market than we have had historically, many companies were able to push through price increases that are going to be very slow to reverse, and in some cases, possibly may never reverse because of their newly discovered market power in that process. With all that said, the reason I think bonds are actually quite interesting is tied to three individual factors. One is the growing dominance of passive investing in bond indices creates predictable distortions in the bond indices that are a byproduct of index construction. Let's table that. We'll come back to it. The second is understanding that inflation, as people broadly discuss it, meaning that rise in the general price level, has largely ended and is actually almost deflationary in its underlying construction. The reasons for that are a combination of demographics and a combination of the fact that I believe interest rates, at least at the short term, are too high. And as a result, this is actually leading to significant declines in the interest rate sensitive portions of the economy, like housing. And then the third component is candidly just the risk that exists in other asset classes. So equities are trading at extraordinarily high valuations. They, in turn, those valuations are dependent not just on the passive bid, but increasingly on an isolated bid where people have convinced themselves that a few leading technology companies somehow or another have the unique answer to what is going to happen into the future. That means that U.S. equity markets that most investors are invested in are increasingly less diversified and increasingly riskier, even if we ignore the much higher valuations that they're trading at. So those three factors are really why I'm trying to get people to take a serious look at bonds, which have changed radically in their configuration, with yields much higher than they were almost at any time in the past couple of decades. That's actually creating opportunities for boomers to start the rotation process and look at their portfolios in terms of what they actually need to replace in terms of their income going forward, not simply invest for speculative gains.
So what are some of the, let's say, current problems with bonds, as you wrote to the Treasury Secretary? You know, you wrote this open letter to them, really laying this out. So why don't we start with why there are so many bonds basically stuck within the banking system at this point?
Well, so the issue with the banking system is that when banks buy bonds or buy securities that are quote unquote risk-free, and then a change in the underlying condition, for example, an increase in interest rates, causes those bonds to mark down in price. And this is just very simple math. If the Treasury issues a 30-year bond at 1% and interest rates subsequently go to 5%, that bond has to offer capital appreciation to offset the much lower coupon than it is paying relative to new issue bonds, which are being issued at 5%. The mechanics of that are simply to roughly look at the next 30 years and say, okay, each year we need an additional 4 points of return. Therefore, that's going to require that bond to fall in price somewhere into the neighborhood of 55 to 60 cents. That bond suddenly becomes very interesting for a retail investor, but for a bank, they would have to recognize the losses associated with that. And as banks tend to run relatively levered, and because their portfolios, when a portfolio takes a loss like that on a riskless asset, it would require them to impair their capital and hurt their ability to lend into the market. So they move those bonds into what's called hold to maturity, acknowledging that it was, quote unquote, a bad investment. They made a mistake, but not recognizing the losses because they are going to amortize them effectively over the next 30 years. That's what the hold to maturity category is. It's what Silicon Valley Bank and many, many other banks have done over the past several years. Unfortunately, that ties up a significant fraction of capital in this hold to maturity category that simply can't be touched, or it will immediately become impaired and cause banks to experience catastrophic losses that impair their ability to continue in their process of lending capital. My proposal to the Treasury is very straightforward. Simply replace the market value of those bonds with current issue coupon bonds at 5%. That allows those bonds to become liquid, and also establish a security instrument, give or take 35 cents in value, that is simply the amortization of the gains that they would have seen in their other portfolios. It's non-interest bearing, it becomes part of their statutory capital, and it prevents them from having to recognize that loss, while at the same time, it liberates the capital that is currently tied up in the banking system, is creating some of the conditions in which mortgages are trading at increased spreads relative to treasuries. Many forms of corporate lending or individual lending are restricted from banks. And this would be a solution for it that would have very little impact on the Treasury. It would cause a modest increase in coupons. It would also cause a mechanical decrease in the amount of Treasury securities outstanding, so the debt to GDP would fall. And it simultaneously would liquefy components of the banking balance sheet, which is always an extraordinarily helpful thing in a market that is in an economy in which we rely on the credit provision from banks to identify the cost of capital for the private sector, not so much for the public sector.
Michael, are there any possible negatives to that scenario? Like, obviously, we need to balance what levers we pull, but are there any negative outcomes of that change within the bond market?
Realistically, no. The only negative that you could point to is slightly higher coupon payments that are offset by lower principal payments by the U.S. Treasury. And so it is a bit of an accounting artifact, but it's recognizing that the accounting itself, the regulatory framework and accounting, is an arbitrary choice. We're not helping the banks in any way other than helping them to liquefy their portfolios and in turn helping the broader economy. This is not a bailout in which they are suddenly facing much higher profitability or the ability to ignore the losses on those assets. They were ignoring them already. And that is actually part of the problem is that the regulatory framework says once you decide to ignore this loss, recognizing that it's not a credit impairment, it's a rate impairment caused by the increase in interest rates, that suddenly actually has negative ramifications for the broader economy. And there's no reason for us to penalize the broader economy for that type of mistake.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that banks run relatively levered. Does this decrease some of that leverage, or is that a different and separate problem?
Well, it's not actually a problem. And I think that's actually critical to understand. Banks' business is actually borrowing money from individuals and other businesses and lending it to people who actually need it. It's effectively a location transfer of money or a time travel of money that allows it to go to where it could be used best in the current situation. That's the idea behind credit provision. It's one of the reasons why it's so valuable to have in the private sector, because you effectively split up those pools of capital that otherwise might be allocated by the government. And you create conditions under which an individual assessing any individual idea, the credit allocation process, a senior loan officer, is able to say, I expect this to be a positive expected return project. And therefore, I'm willing to put some of my depositors' capital and some of the bank's capital into extending this credit. That's the way the system is supposed to work. It's quite valuable to actually have entities that are capable of running themselves in a levered fashion where they are taking advantage of the fact that you don't need your money today to make it available to others today at an interest rate that compensates both you as a depositor and the bank as an investor.
Mm-hmm. Michael, is there also an issue with the structure of the bond market and how that has changed over the last 6 years? You know, Bessent was critical of Yellen and how she had sold so much on the short end of the curve and yet has continued a lot of that. Is that one of the issues kind of facing this, or one of the problems to take into account here as well?
It definitely is. And this is one of the areas in which I disagree with Secretary Bessent in terms of the ramifications and implications of his actions. We are seeing long-dated rates in the United States push 5%. That is creating understandable concern in a narrative framework that says the U.S. is losing its ability to finance itself. And one of the really critical things to understand is that this is simply untrue. We're seeing the same interest rate behavior across the developed world, whether it's a country like the United States that's running 100% debt to GDP, or Japan that's running 150 to 200% debt to GDP. China, because of its individual control and its lack of Western status, has its own interesting dynamics around interest rates. But if we look at a country like Australia, where debt to GDP is only 25%, they're seeing the exact same behavior in their bonds. That suggests this is not actually a credit issue. Although I understand that narrative is seductive, we all like to think of governments having to be responsible like individual households. If individual households were capable of printing their own money, Mike Bucks, for example, we'd probably behave much more like the government and lose our ability to control our spending. Raising interest rates doesn't actually restrict the government from spending, except in a narrative sense, in a quote-unquote general sense of concern. In fact, it actually increases the amount of money that the government is spending and transferring into the private sector by raising those interest rates, and that is a fiscal transfer. This is one of the really key things to understand. When you're running at 100% debt to GDP and the Federal Reserve or the central bank raises interest rates, that actually is increasing the amount of money the government is spending and is a form of fiscal stimulus that hits certain target groups at the same time that it restricts that credit function and that ability of individual private sector entities to borrow and spend as they see best fit. So you're actually increasing the allocative function of the government when you raise interest rates. You're not restricting it in a critical sense like you would with a household. And so once you understand that, you understand that the theory that we're operating under is largely incorrect. We're actually in the United States engaged in fiscal transfer, not so much monetary policy. We're driving an increasing concentration in our economic system, in which individuals who had borrowed money at very low rates have now seen the debt that they owe fall in value. The mortgage that you borrowed at 2.75% in 2021, when you refinanced your home into record low mortgage rates, is now trading at roughly 50 cents on the dollar. Part of the reason why people don't want to sell their homes, and this is restricting the supply of homes being offered from the boomers, is because they would have to pay back that bond at par. They would have to pay it back at 100 cents on the dollar, even though it's paying at 55 cents because of the terms of that contractual agreement. Nobody in their right mind wants to pay 100 cents for something that's currently trading at 55 cents. That's why we're seeing a restriction of supply in the housing market. This would be one of the mechanisms that ultimately starts to address that process. The second thing to understand is that when we start thinking about the behavior at the front end and the long end, my analysis is that this is largely caused by the way we choose to invest in bond indices. Bond indices are market cap weighted. That means that they have a very peculiar property to them. Imagine a very simple bond index in which there's only two bonds, a two-year bond and a 30-year bond. They're equal weight at the start. If the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, the two-year bond does not rise very much in price. It does rise slightly in price, but it doesn't rise very much in price because it's a very short-dated bond. You're going to receive that principal and that coupon payment in a short period of time, so current interest rate policy doesn't have much effect on it. It's what's called duration exposure. The 30-year bond, as I was describing previously, will change a lot in price. When the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, the 30-year bond tends to rally, reflecting the idea that interest rates will be lower in the future, your reinvestment opportunities will be worse, and therefore that 5% coupon bond is much more valuable. If you think about the structure of that bond index, it's now going to carry less weight in twos and more weight in 30s because the Federal Reserve cut interest rates. That means that investment in passive bond indices will send more money to the 30-year bond, less money to the two-year bond. Now the Federal Reserve hikes interest rates aggressively. The reverse happens. The two-year bond falls just a little bit in price. The 30-year bond falls a lot in price. Now the index is underweight that 30-year bond, and your contributions into your target date fund and your 401k, you know, sort of life cycle fund, or your investment in a bond index is going to buy more twos and less 30s. That's a big chunk of what the Treasury is reacting to. And part of my observation is that the Treasury can actually take advantage of this phenomenon, use its issuance schedule to restructure the bond market so that there is more demand for the 30-year bond than there is currently. That would actually be very helpful. The second thing that is a real issue is when you enter into a period of very low interest rates, as we in Japan and others have done, you've increased that stock of long-dated bonds that you're carrying low coupons. And so when the Federal Reserve hikes interest rates, as it did in 21 and 22, that pushes the value of those bonds down and creates the collateral stresses that we were just describing in the banking system, as well as some perverse components like individual household owners having wildly different outcomes depending on when they borrowed the money to buy their house. So the same house at a 2.75% interest rate is radically more affordable than the exact same price home issued at a 7% mortgage rate for fairly obvious reasons. That's a big chunk of what we're seeing, as I mentioned before, in terms of the lack of availability in the housing market, the lack of affordability, et cetera. And it candidly has caused a broad collapse in the housing market, both on the supply side from secondary home sellers who recognize that they cannot replace their home with an equivalent mortgage. It also is creating conditions under which new construction has fallen, ultimately impacting both jobs and the ability of young families to afford housing. Mm-hmm.
So because of the, you know, let's say manipulations within the bond market, Michael, do we currently have a scenario where we don't have true price discovery within that market?
I think that's correct. I think what we effectively have is buyers and sellers are mechanically driven apart by this behavior. Banks who would like to sell those bonds are incapable of selling them because of the hold to maturity. Individuals who might think they're buying those bonds by allocating into a bond index are buying less of the bonds that are deeply discounted, more of the bonds that are trading at relatively high prices. That creates dysfunction in the bond market that ultimately is quite caustic to the ability of the United States to finance itself and the ability of the economy to provide credit where it is needed.
So when we look at, again, the let's say the causes of that distortion, do the passive fund flows have a role to play in that as well?
Well, I think they have a huge role in it. If what we've actually seen in the bond market is explosive growth in passive bond indices, in indexing and passive bond funds, ironically, this is rarely because of the outperformance of those funds. In fact, the bond market is one of the areas in which passive is notably underperformed active managers. But because of the way funds are now distributed, largely through the 401k process and largely subject to the fiduciary rule, it is very difficult for bond funds to actually be issued that are actively managed and going into a 401k account. Roughly 85 cents of every retirement dollar in the United States is coming through a 401k, is now flowing into a passive bond fund in a target date fund type framework that's causing rapid share gain of this type of investing that honestly makes no sense in bonds. I understand why people do it. It's easy to explain. It's very similar to how we think about it with the equity markets, but it has distinct and important implications for both the United States and individual investors to understand.
Michael, in the article, you write that we are very close to a real crisis. Why do you say that, and where does that crisis emanate from?
Well, the crisis ultimately emanates from the characterization of monetary policy as fiscal policy. When we have this quantity of debt outstanding, unless we are actively managing that market, we run a very significant risk that long-dated bond starts to move to the point that it drives reference securities like mortgages, et cetera, to the point that they simply become dysfunctional. Fewer and fewer people can afford new homes today or afford to buy a home today. That, of course, means that fewer and fewer people can sell homes efficiently and match their retirement expectations versus what they had originally planned or what they think the home is worth. We're skating very close to the point, like 2008, in which we begin to see mortgages significantly fall underwater. We begin to see distress as fewer job opportunities are created because of the impaired credit function. We're beginning to see the cyclical sectors of the economy, after having rebounded briefly, begin to deteriorate again. If these choices are made during a period of significant economic distress, not the relative strength that we're experiencing now, we run the risk that this actually creates a crisis in which the U.S. government believes it is forced to seek whatever financing is available. I think that would be incredibly unfortunate and quite without support in any sort of real sense.
So in that scenario where we face this crisis, Michael, is it possible that the bond market gets crushed as well? And is it, you know, is this more of an idea of investing in that market at a particular time in order to, let's say, not lose capital or try to maximize those gains?
I think that there's a combination of features there. First, before bond markets collapse, equity markets tend to collapse. And so it is critical to understand that when you're talking about investing, you're not simply talking about is one the absolute perfect choice versus the other. Part of what I'm articulating is particularly for those who are now approaching the end of their lives and have accumulated enough resources that they can live off of the traditional 4% withdrawal rule or the new variant of that, which is a 3% withdrawal rule. If you look at bonds, they're currently offering you interest rates that allow you to fulfill those objectives without any of the risks associated with equities. You absolutely will get your money back. You absolutely will get the income that is promised to you through the coupons. The equity markets cannot say that. And I think that's really critical for people to understand. Part of what we're experiencing is we have a society in which people who are older and should be transitioning to fixed income to maximize their income in retirement that facilitates their spending. And as a byproduct of that spending actually creates more jobs for their children, et cetera. We're actually seeing more and more hoarding activity, which is an unfortunate byproduct of how we've chosen to build our retirement system, in which we think about retirement as hoarding assets for sale as compared to creating income to replace the income that we earned when we were younger and working. That's really the critical thing to understand is that the current situation that we have is not a good one. And everybody involved in this process, ranging from boomers who look at their current situation and say, oh my gosh, I'm so fearful because my retirement is tied up in highly valued equities. I lived through 2000. I saw the fears associated with it, but I don't really have any alternative because I hear how terrible bonds are. Part of what I'm trying to do is emphasize to people, bond markets have changed radically over the last 4 years. It's really important for people to actually understand that and to take into consideration the current configuration, not just what has happened over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to this crisis idea. And you mentioned that it is, you know, somewhat tied to, let's say, the value of mortgages and the value of housing. How much of it is also, you know, tied to this overvaluation of the stock markets?
Well, I think that they're complementary in a bad sense, in that highly appreciated stock holdings create the capacity to pay more for properties. And so we've seen a bifurcation of the housing market in the same manner that we've seen other components of our economy bifurcate, what we call the K-shaped economy. Young families that don't have access to significant parental wealth have no prospect of buying a home. If your parents are able to give you the money or lend you the money, you suddenly are capable of buying almost any house you'd like. And so this is creating a very bifurcated outcome. Likewise, boomers are holding on to their homes. They're much larger homes than they otherwise would. Because their mortgages are so, quote unquote, cheap, they can afford to keep a 3,500 square foot house that has plenty of room for their kids to live in it, which many children are starting, adult children are taking advantage of. Rather than downsizing, buying a 1,500 square foot condo that would be more appropriate for their age, and in turn creating additional liquidity that could be used to finance consumption in their retirement. They're simply trapped by the existing mortgage that they have that reduces the availability of the 3,500 square foot house to the person who wants to then move up because they are older, have children, have done well in their jobs, et cetera. This is creating basically a frozen market, and the entire point of markets is for things to trade.
So in that scenario, Michael, what is the, let's say, the likeliest path for the Fed to take? Obviously, there's so many different variables to take into account here, but does this come back to, you know, dropping rates and printing like mad in order to try to, let's say, stem the leak in the dam?
Well, that's actually what I'm trying to draw attention to, is that a prophylactic response, an advance made in response in advance of the crisis, actually can reduce the need to do that. But the way it exists currently, you know, if we were to enter into a crisis, if we were to enter into a recession, the odds are extremely high that one of the forms of bailing out the banking system would be to cut interest rates back to zero. That would cause those bonds that are in the hold to maturity category to appreciate to the point that the banks would ultimately be able to liquefy them. And that would actually provide support to the banking system. That's what we have been doing, is responding to every crisis by cutting interest rates, increasing the collateral value of bonds. The problem is, if we do it this time, we're also creating conditions under which a significant fiscal transfer then gets removed. So the money that you're currently receiving on your money market funds or short-dated bonds, the two-year bond on in, those would actually collapse under that framework, and many households would find themselves with reduced spending capacity. In other words, the actions of the Federal Reserve would almost certainly be net contractionary to the household sector. The traditional playbook simply doesn't work in this framework. What I'm actually trying to do is encourage a response in advance as compared to what the Fed has continually said. We are data dependent. We are backward looking, right? That's not helpful. Driving with your rear view mirror is not particularly helpful. If you're going to be involved, you need to be thoughtful about what the future looks like and what the road looks like that you're approaching, not the road that you've traveled down in the past. And so really, this is a proposal designed to minimize the need to crush interest rates to zero. In the absence of these types of actions, unfortunately, I think we'll find ourselves right back in that cycle where the Federal Reserve is forced to cut interest rates aggressively. And that could very well prove to be contractionary because of this fiscal component.
So all of this being said and taken into consideration, did you get a response from the Treasury, or have you heard any musings about any feedback for these ideas?
The quick answer is there definitely has been feedback. There's definitely interest in understanding it. The simple reality is I think it's very difficult to explain this to both the Federal Reserve, although I know that they are considering it and thinking about it. It's incredibly difficult to explain to the average public. The idea that interest rate cuts could actually be contractionary is somewhat novel. It's certainly not unique to me, but it definitely plays a role in many individuals' thought process and many forms of heterodox economics. But the most important point is that I think it flies in the face of what the administration ultimately wants, which is lower interest rates. And so I'm not sure that we're going to see the action that is necessary. It's why I made it an open letter. My hope is that people will pick it up, read it, attempt to understand it. If they don't understand it, ask questions. You can feed it into an LLM. This is one of the things that I would encourage people to do, is literally take the essay, drop it into a large language model and ask it to explain it like you're five. I attempted to do components of that. But it's really critical for people to understand this type of proposal and ultimately push politicians to understand that there are different types of actions that can be taken. There are prophylactic ones, basically putting a condom on before you have sex. That's a really good idea if you're going to try something novel, right? This is actually that sort of process. I don't know how else to frame it, right? I mean, that is the word for it. And so I think it's really critical for people to understand that we want policymakers looking forward, not looking backward. And right now, all they're doing is looking in the rearview mirror.
Well, in the interest of looking forward and trying to understand, let's say, ways out of this or best ways to deal with the problems, obviously one of the solutions that has been pointed to would be revaluing the gold that's held on the Treasury's balance sheet. Do you think that does enough to offset enough of the debt to GDP ratio that we do see as a major issue here?
I don't think it has any impact whatsoever. I think it's a fantasy, right? That's part of the reason why I introduced Australia. They're experiencing the same degradation in their coupon markets as we are, despite the fact that they have 25% debt to GDP. So a revaluation of the gold that everybody already knows is trading at $4,500 that the U.S. government currently carries on at roughly $45 on its balance sheet has no practical impact. There's no rating agency that's sitting out there saying, gosh, you know, if the U.S. just had more assets, we would make sure people borrowed money from them more cheaply. It doesn't work that way. And that's one of the reasons why I highlight that this is not a U.S. phenomenon. This is a Western phenomenon. And basically anywhere you see bond indices, you're going to see this type of behavior. It's a mechanical feature of our decision to invest passively in bond markets.
Hmm. Well, in that, like, I understand that you're saying if we revalue gold, it doesn't make people, let's say, trust the dollar anymore. But what if, in the respect that, you know, Judy Shelton has said, for example, about actually trying to monetize the gold by selling these long dated gold backed bonds, does that have any value to you?
No, I think it's absolutely silly, right? The United States has a very small, what's called risk premium associated with its borrowing. Backing the bonds with gold simply introduces another high volatility asset that would similarly carry a premium associated with it. I don't know how much gold is going to be worth in 100 years. I assume it's going to be worth more than it is today. But the uncertainty around that means that that bond actually has to have a spread associated with it. It's, in my opinion, just a silly move, right? Why create those conditions if it does actually nothing to lower your borrowing costs? I understand it if you're Zimbabwe. I don't understand it if you're the United States.
So, Michael, you know, when we think about the, let's say, the behavior of the average consumer, trying to keep up with inflation is, let's say, the very base level of what they're, you know, attempting to do with savings or investing. How high do you think is true inflation within the country? And has the behavior of the Fed with all of these interventions driven the consumer up the risk ladder in order to seek these yields?
I don't think that that's the case, but I want to be really clear. First, I've written extensively on this topic. The issue that most people have with affordability is that the vast majority of our economy, give or take 60% of it, was operating relatively close to zero savings anyway. And so when you experience inflation like you had, at zero savings just means I make $100 and I spend $100. If we have an inflationary episode like we had in 2021 and 2022, and the general price level rises, let's say 20% to make our life simple, then suddenly my spending is 120, my income is 100, and I'm deeply underwater. The subsequent inflation falling to 2% doesn't really help me because I'm still underwater. In fact, I'm probably underwater by more because if the price level is 120 and we get 2% inflation, that means that we go to roughly 124 in terms of the price level, slightly less than that. My income, if it rises by 2%, which the government would then say, hey, you're perfectly happy, goes to 102. Suddenly, instead of being $20 underwater, I'm now $22 underwater, and the government is telling me everything is totally fine. It's not remotely fine, right? I'm further underwater, even though inflation has retreated. That's why it's really critical to understand that inflation is different than the price level. The inflation rate contributes to the realization of the price level, but it's really not. Hold on, give me 2 seconds to close the curtain here. There we go. Sunrise in Hawaii just came up. Let's see here. Okay. And so what people are experiencing when they say, you know, 59% of American households can't afford $1,000 unexpected expense is really that depleted level of income relative to your spending. And we actually just saw the savings rate in response to the increase in gasoline prices associated with the U.S.-Iran war in the Straits of Hormuz fall to the lowest levels that we've ever seen in history. That means that a sizable fraction of the U.S. population is underwater. And so I want to be really, really clear. There is a legitimate concern out there with the level of prices and the costs of participating in our society and our economy. One of the ways we reduce that is actually by encouraging investment and encouraging competition in the business sector so that there are more companies fighting for that share of your wallet that you're now being forced to increasingly be careful with how you spend it. But that's not inflation is the problem. It's the price level. And in a period of extraordinary corporate profitability, in a period in which a growing fraction of young people find themselves incapable of servicing their student loan debts that they took on with the expectation that they would be placed in premium jobs that are now disappearing because of AI or other components, this is creating understandable social friction. And the government's inability to understand that is notable. I was shocked by a New York Fed piece that came out the other day that talked about consumer sentiment, and it highlighted that people were actually doing just fine because their spending had maintained its level, right? That's a little bit like saying, you know, well, yes, I know that you're starving, but you're not starving any more than you were yesterday. And they then went even further in their analysis, and they said, if we look at the breakdown between those people who got better jobs, who changed jobs and got better jobs and got paid more, they are less unhappy. Their sentiment hasn't shown the same deterioration as people who increased their capacity to spend by working more hours or taking on second jobs. And I'm sorry, but part of my response to that is like that actually required a PhD in economics to understand that somebody who gets a better job that pays more money with the same amount of effort is not as unhappy as somebody who is forced to work more hours or an additional job in order to maintain their current level of spending. Like if this is the level of analysis that we have coming from our leadership, like we deserve everything that comes our way, or we should replace our leadership.
Well, I think that's, you know, that system is in place to perpetuate that system, right? And
I think it's very easy to take it in the framework of it's a giant conspiracy designed to perpetuate the system. All systems are designed in large part to perpetuate the system. And I think the vast majority of us would acknowledge that perpetuating the current system is far better than sliding backwards into an economic dystopian like The Walking Dead or any of the things that we were fearful before COVID, you know, really kind of made a reality of some of those things for some households. This is a pretty good system, right? It is better than all the other systems in a lot of ways. And so perpetuating it is not bad, but improving it is better. And that's really what I think we have the opportunity to do. It is frustrating to me that very simple actions that would actually identify the problems that exist in our economy, a lack of competition, a lack of opportunity for young people, a lack of spending and confidence in spending by the older generations. These are all things that can be addressed. It can be addressed relatively simply without, as the current mantra goes, just burning it all down. When you burn it all down, millions of people die. It's just that straightforward. And so if that's your objective, I understand. I understand the frustration. I understand the challenges that individual households and individuals face with the price level being too high, and in particular costs like childcare, et cetera, that didn't exist for their parents' generation, being increasingly unaffordable, preventing them from forming households, preventing them from getting married, preventing them from having children, and as a result, in many ways, cutting them off from the promise of the future. These are all things that we have to address. We have to address them as a society, and policymakers need to play a critical role in leading us through that process. Or again, we need to change our leadership. Mm-hmm.
Michael, going back to the current constraints on the Strait of Hormuz, and now the Bab el-Mandeb Strait as well, do you think that this leads us to another bout of inflation like we did see in 2022?
I think it's unlikely. And the reason why is really critical to understand. The inflation in the 1970s was a byproduct of the United States moving from being an exporter of oil and fossil fuels to being an importer of oil and fossil fuels. That meant that it was the equivalent of the world's richest consumer coming into your local grocery store and saying, gosh, everything looks so cheap. The world price for oil was set by marginal and much less wealthy economies. The United States shows up. We have no price limits on it, really. And as a result, the price of oil rises significantly. This time around, we've actually cut off more of the global shipments of oil. But because the richest country in the world is now an oil exporter again due to shale, it's having far less impact. The countries that are being impacted are largely in the third world, amongst the poorest countries in the world. As a result, we're seeing demand fall off far faster than we're actually seeing supply. I think if anything, the risks of the Straits of Hormuz reopening and lots of surplus oil being released could end up with oil prices falling significantly, as we're seeing production rise in other areas, as we're resolving transportation issues in the Straits of Hormuz by sourcing it in different locations. So I understand the catastrophic fear. It is possible that we enter into a framework in which oil prices spike significantly, but we've already seen a significant destruction of demand that is radically different than what we saw in the 1970s when both population growth and the emergence of the U.S. on the traded oil scene caused prices to rise to an extraordinary degree in a manner that is not even remotely close to being repeated this cycle.
Interesting. So, Michael, we're also, you know, there's so many things to try to take into consideration and to factor into the calculus of this time. Obviously, you know, the Strait of Hormuz being a massive one, but we're also coming into a time of some of the biggest IPOs ever, right? SpaceX being one of them, mm-hmm. among others that are that have been announced. So, you know, you mentioned before we started recording that the S&P denied this IPO. What are the biggest things that we need to understand about these IPOs and their characteristics at this time?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are really critical in that process. One, remember that all prices are set by the intersection of supply and demand. And so the United States in the 1970s chose to change our retirement system from a defined benefit system, which offers you income in your retirement and pools it across many participants in a pension plan, that allows you to take advantage of the actuarial expected life of an individual, right? I have no idea how long you're going to live, Tom. I have no idea how long I'm going to live or any individual man on the street. But for a 55-year-old man, I can say with pretty reasonable accuracy, I would expect the average 55-year-old man to live to approximately 82 years, and therefore they have, give or take, 27 years left in terms of their life expectancy. I can use that in a pension plan and build a portfolio that's built around that expected case. On an individual basis, if I'm saving for my retirement in a defined contribution plan, I have no idea how long I'm going to live. I could theoretically live for another 50 years, double that expected level. And therefore, I have to accumulate far more financial resources for that that possibility of an unexpected retirement, which would be catastrophic for me as an individual. That creates an outward shift in aggregate demand for financial assets, and in particular equities, that is absolutely played out. We also then chose in 2006 to change our 401k system from an opt-in system in which benefits were offered for those who chose to participate to an opt-out system in which people were forced into the system and forced to save for retirement, which is ultimately a good thing, but is candidly a confusing process. And so we had to offer them a very simple way to do so, hence the designation of a target date fund and the use of passive investment vehicles as the mechanism to make it easy for people to save. They simply pile their money in. That also causes an outward shift in aggregate demand for financial assets because, among other things, those vehicles hold less cash. They are allocating on the basis of market cap, so they will pay more for richly valued securities than for, they'll allocate more to richly valued securities than to less richly valued securities. That is another shift in aggregate demand. And so what we're actually seeing is an imbalanced system in which constantly rising prices and valuations are required to solve that intersection of supply and demand. Suddenly we're talking about changing the supply. And so if you just think in economic terms where you draw the simple supply-demand curves associated with economics, we've shifted demand out to the right. That causes prices and valuations to rise. Now, suddenly, potentially, we're actually shifting supply out to the right, increasing the quantity of supply. And that has the prospect of lowering prices and lowering valuations and lowering returns. If people are investing not because they understand the companies that they invest in, which they don't in a passive framework, those lower prices and lower valuations and realized lower returns can actually perversely cause more people to decide to sell. I apologize for the air conditioning. And that's the key risk. So we are now finally seeing the indices themselves start to change their composition and their rules to facilitate an increase in supply. The importance of the S&P announcement was they basically gave the Heisman to Elon and said, no, we're not going to beg for your capital. We're not going to beg for your listing. We're going to respect the investors that are already allocated into our index and behave in a somewhat fiduciary manner. That's an incredible oversight that currently exists in the system. You allocate to an individual manager or to a registered investment advisor, they have a requirement to consider the fiduciary components and the relative attractiveness of that asset. A passive vehicle doesn't have to do that. In fact, some formulations are actually designed now to increase the weights of those new high price issues to facilitate the IPO. That, in my opinion, is a tremendous oversight and candidly an abuse of the trust that individuals have placed in passive equity indices. the ultimate impact of this is unknown. It hasn't happened before, but if we think through it on a logical basis, any increase in supply ultimately should result in lower prices and lower valuations. I don't think the SpaceX one is actually going to be the end of it all. But if all of these IPOs happen, if this incredible increase in supply comes, it's unlikely that the markets digest them without a hiccup. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know, I did an interview last week that the gentleman said that likely what's going to happen into June here, or I guess it would have been 2 weeks ago, is a sell-off in order to get liquidity to be able to put into some of these massive IPOs. Is that a reasonable explanation in your opinion as to the sell-off that we have seen over the past 3 to 4 days here?
I think there's definitely some truth to that. I think in particular, things like Bitcoin were probably negatively affected as people decided to move from one speculative asset to another speculative asset. We're always seeking that great solution that makes our retirement totally transparent and very easy because we're rich beyond our wildest dreams. SpaceX at least holds some of that promise. Bitcoin has seen much of that promise evaporate over the last 5 years. That, you know, naturally engenders people to sell Bitcoin and buy SpaceX, and often those are happening on the same platform, like a Coinbase, etc. We haven't seen a ton of evidence of a lot of selling. We've seen some evidence of some areas, in particular Korea and semiconductor stocks, have been negatively affected. There was an extraordinary influx of capital into passive indices from basically April through May. It would be natural to expect some of that to be given back, particularly given the uncertainties of midterm elections approaching, a new Federal Reserve chair, and these IPOs. And so I'm not surprised that the quote-unquote sell-in may go away framework has somewhat played out already. Whether this continues and whether it's ameliorated by SpaceX's IPO, it remains to be seen. Ultimately, there will be pressure on other securities to make room for SpaceX in the NASDAQ 100. I'm not convinced it's going to be quite as much as people think it's going to be. It'll definitely be supportive of a transfer of wealth from your pocket to Elon's pocket, though.
So I just want to, let's say, underscore this point, Michael. The idea of more than one of these plus trillion-dollar IPOs coming into the market, how do we take these things, or how do we view them as investors when there are several of them happening at this time? Is this, you know, a possibility of just the, let's say, the insiders of these companies trying to gain the liquidity that they want from to provide themselves with an exit, let's say, of these private investments?
The quick answer is, of course, yes, right? We do need to be aware that this is a transfer of wealth, or more accurately, liquidity from your reserves into the individuals that currently hold these quote-unquote illiquid securities. This is not 2000. I want to be very, very clear on that. The scale of these individual IPOs is significant. It is happening in a much larger market. And so it is critical to understand that the relative scale is less. The second thing is that many of the insiders and individuals in these entities have already had periods of liquidity. Secondary markets that were introduced in 2012, you can trade SpaceX on a secondary market. It is actively traded, actively monitored. Do they have the same depth of liquidity that exists in the primary markets? Absolutely not. But many individuals have already taken some of that liquidity out. And so again, this is not going to be quite as transparent as 2000, when Sir John Templeton, the founder of Templeton Funds, very famously and presciently decided to purchase put options on individual new issues at the expiry of insider lockups, basically identifying that that is the point at which supply is going to emerge. The perverse component here is that this has all been about demand management. How do we actually force allocations into passive equity indices that to me is far more manipulative, but it also means that this, the demand side of the equation is less at risk than, and the supply side of the equation is probably a little bit less at risk than we saw with the sudden liquidity that was created in the 2000 example. I don't think they're directly comparable, but I think it is very easy for people to look at them in that framework and convince themselves of the narrative that this is going to be a disaster. I think it's a problem. I don't think this is the disaster.
Mm-hmm. Well, Michael, I really appreciate you forcing us to think a little bit differently about some of these things. I know that it is, again, easy to find any information to reinforce your opinion. And I find it very valuable to try to think outside the box. And I appreciate you taking the time to help our listeners do that. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about as we wrap up here?
I think the really critical component that I always try to emphasize to people is take the time to educate yourself, read the actual formative literature, not just the commentary that's coming from talking heads like myself. Try to understand how economics works, how governments are different, and candidly, the implications of that for what we should expect from our leadership. We're expecting all the wrong things for us. It's not their job to give us quote unquote good outcomes. It's their jobs to give us a system that is coherent, that allows us to pursue outcomes that are in our own self-interest in a way that is as fair as possible, with as much access to legal recourse as we can possibly obtain under, you know, thoughtful components. We don't want people lying to us. We don't want people misrepresenting what products contain, et cetera. The government's role is not to fix the problems. The government's role is to fix the underlying infrastructure that allows us to fix the problems. And eventually we'll get there. I have high confidence that the generations that follow us won't be quite as tainted and corrupted as the generations that are currently in charge. Mm-hmm.
Well, I appreciate the positive note. You know, it's easy to look at everything in such a doom and gloom lens. And I think some optimism, despite the current sentiments, is an excellent place to kind of put a pin in it.
All right.
Of course, Michael, for the listeners that do want to check out your writing, that's all available at yesigiveafig.com. And of course on X as well, at profplum99. Michael, thank you so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Tom, thank you for having me.